Hello, everyone. I'm Leslie Cornwell, certified nurse midwife with Midwifery Business Consultation. I'm very excited. This is my first midwifery birth panel. So far, we've been doing just one-on-one, picking the brains of their expertise. And I said, I've been talking to so much amazing knowledge that they've been in the midwifery world for 30, 40, even sometimes 50 years that I'm like, I want this knowledge, especially the history side of midwifery, to be discussed. So I'm going to let each of these wonderful ladies that I've gotten to know talk about themselves a little bit, and then we'll go over an overview of the topics we'll go over today. So Kathy, if you want to go first, because I see you first on my screen.
Okay, sure. Kathy Gordon, I am currently moving out of midwifery, so not in a bad way, but in a good way. I have been a birth center owner for years and started replicating the birth center model, and also provided care in the hospitals, and I've done some home births. So, but my primary practice and entrepreneurship is replicating birth centers and being a champion for the birth center model. So that's what I'm bringing here today. And I love midwives and I love moms and babies, and let's do this.
Thank you so much. And then Carolyn, you can go next.
Hi, I'm Carolyn Gager, and I have a long history in healthcare. I started in, it's been 50 years since I was a registered nurse, and worked in labor and delivery for a number of years. Also began a career-long interest in ultrasound in OBGYN, and became a midwife in 1988. And have, since that time, I worked in tertiary care hospitals and became program director at Georgetown University for a while. So I did the educational deal, went back to clinical practice, and now I'm semi-retired and have a business called Ultrasound for Midwives. And I'm teaching midwives to do ultrasound, both virtually as well as doing hands-on scanning.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Carolyn, for being here today. And then not least, but the most to Hillary, if you can tell me, I know I was trying to say that last but not least is the word I was trying to say.
And I'm Hillary Schlinger, and I live in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I come from originally the licensed midwife route, and I was licensed as a licensed midwife in New Mexico in 1982, and 20 years later became a CNM, and never practiced in the hospital, always practiced doing home birth and birth center births, and for the last 4 years have been involved in CPM education and have been the program director for a CPM program in Wisconsin previously, and now I'm the program director for a program in Florida at the International Institute for Healthcare Professionals. So birth center, yes, home birth, yes, hospital birth, no, but obviously when you attend home births and birth center births, you do end up at some hospital births.
Well, thank you so much for everyone being here today. I think if we just start at a high level overview, what are the big things each one of you has noticed as a transition since you started your midwifery career, whether it's on the woman's right side, whether it's adding technology? I'd love to hear each one of the things. When I brought up this topic to you, what jumped out as the biggest transition? And I'll start with Kathy just because I can see you first.
I'm not sure I'm not sure what you want me
just
to say.
Just like a big, yeah, like my, more generalized, after the last 40 years, when you've seen so much birth, and you can go whatever direction you prefer, like whether it's the implementation of technology, I know before we started the recording,
yes,
whatever direction you want to start with, and
yeah,
we can more.
You bet. So it's easy to say, let's go back to 1980. And I can say it very simply that was the year I gave birth to my first child. And as being in the nursing world, midwifery world already, and giving birth and seeing that transition from 1980 to 2020, birth has changed horrifically. And I say it, and in some ways it's changed to better the family, to bring the family back in, but not like it was maybe in 1920. So with the emergence of the ACOG and journal writing and marketing of hospitals for babies to be born in the hospital. So what if I can use myself as the best example, about that time, you know, there was the mortality rate was about 200 deaths per year of pregnancy related deaths. Now in the US we're 600. We've doubled that number twice. And so when I look at that, and I shared with our own midwives that I had a better chance of survival in 1980 than we do now in 2020, and our technology and our knowledge has increased in that timeline, the response I have is we have medicalized what we call normal. And normal is women were made to give birth. They were made, our bodies are made to make babies, to grow babies in the womb and to give birth. And our technology and our knowledge has made it risky to give birth, has made it scary to give birth. And it's also made it pain-free technically. And I can't respond to that, but I can just say if we look at our own data and how the United States is one of the worst countries that's industrialized in birth, we have the worst outcomes, especially with mothers dying, than underdeveloped countries. When we look at that, we go, what is the problem? And what has happened since 1980 to 2020 is we lost our midwives. And now we're scrambling to get them back. But they're all starting, most of them, in the medical world, and then tearing down to, wait a minute, a midwife is actually with woman, as we know it. But to understand that birth is normal, oftentimes isn't even taught that way. And I look for our educators here to comment on that. But what I've seen is, when I gave birth, there were no monitors in 1980 strapped around my belly. There was a Doppler, but there were no monitors. And I asked, please, do I really need to have that IV? Can I just do my own thing, labor on my own? And when my water broke, you know, they were like, of course, the cord prolapse fear, but they allowed me to get up and walk. And guess what? They brought me food. Of course, as most laboring women, the smell of that food, no thank you. But nowadays, we've taken that away. And so for those of us that are on the outside of the hospital birthing movement, we feed our moms. We encourage them to be more active. But it's still not the majority. It's like less than 10% still. So birth has changed in the last 40 years from 1980 to 2020 tremendously. We have over-medicalized women, and we've made them all high risk in some capacity, or they believe that they're high risk, and so they're afraid. So what we're doing now is we're trying to give birth back to women, we're trying to give birth back to families. So I'll try not to talk too much and turn it over.
I love it. I think Hillary's gonna go next because she's got a book and she's ready to add her feedback.
I've got a book because as you were talking, and it's, you know, it's interesting where you started this. I too gave birth after being a midwife. I had been at, I think, 300 births before, 290 actually, before I had my first. And I, the book that I picked up off the shelf is called Epiduralized Birth and Nurse Midwifery, Childbirth in the United States. And it actually grew out of a nurse midwife who did a PhD in anthropology. And she talks about the history of it in the, it's this little book that's only available through Amazon. And, but she talks about the interweaving of epidurals and induction and how they're not separate and it's not a merry-go-round, but it becomes all of a piece. And then you have midwives learning what isn't really birth, unmedicalized birth, and then those are the midwives who are put out into the community.
Yes.
And so that was the first thing I thought of. I had a home birth. I was working with a woman from the Onondaga Nation who was a traditional midwife, and she was my midwife at the time. And so, but the other piece was when I look at the, where did the midwifery movement of in the 1970s and 80s, what was the piece that was feminism, and it was taking birth back. There was also this belief that my body could do this, so that women coming into that from the women's self-help movement, and so within that taking back, there was a taking of responsibility that I saw, rather than a giving over of responsibility. There's so many pieces within that. I also think on a national level, when we look at maternal mortality, we've also seen this shift in the healthcare system of getting rid of community hospitals, getting rid of hospitals in rural places. And so then you have people always going to tertiary care hospitals. And there's that loss. And so we have women who are having eclamptic seizures on the road to try to get to a city. You know, there's so many different pieces of what has led to this. So as we've medicalized, how have we gotten rid of the family doctor aspect? How have we gotten rid of the small community hospitals? And I think that those all feed into it as well.
Oh my, you all have said so many things. Now there's so many things to say back to it all.
Well, I think, Carolyn, you'll be helpful with the being on the hospital side and seeing the evolution from the small community hospital to bigger. I think you'll bring a very unique perspective.
I did a lot of work in labor and delivery when I was a student nurse at the hospital. And our C-section rate in 1968 was 5%. And those women were not different than the women that we see now.
Right.
And their outcomes then were just as good as they are now. Actually, they were better. And I remember the first fetal monitor machine being rolled onto the unit and us looking at that saying, what is that? And we left it in the corner to be used for, quote, high-risk patients, which was every once in a while, because not everyone was looked at as being at risk. Now, that's the view. Everyone is at risk until you prove otherwise.
Right.
And it's really very, very difficult to work with. And women feel like they're at risk. I also remember that at the same time was the big Lamaze movement, and so many women were, and families. I mean, literally, I had the couples come in handcuffed together so that the dads wouldn't be left out in the waiting rooms, and got to stay with her. And I used to say, you know, really, when she gets her enema, thank goodness we don't do that anymore. You can uncuff from that and let her go to the bathroom by herself. But those were very, very different days. Epidurals were not the routine.
Right. They weren't available.
They
weren't available.
There wasn't such a thing.
Right.
And fortunately, I miss scopolamine and all of that stuff. So... But women giving birth without medication and walking and having light meals and such was the norm.
Yeah.
But when you don't have the machine, what you do have is one-on-one care. You don't have somebody sitting and watching screens to see how a baby's doing. You have somebody who has to be at the bedside to find out how the baby's doing.
Right.
Or the not bedside if the person is upright.
Up and out in the hallway.
Yeah.
some of the things that also happen, if I go back to 1980, there's things that have changed for the better. For example, I'm going to be some ugly stuff, but you, Carolyn, you mentioned it, the enemas, the shaving.
Oh, yes.
That, you know what I'm saying? And
oh, everyone got shaved, stem to stern,
and the enemas. The leather straps to hold you down.
Oh, yes.
Don't touch the sterile field. I remember saying when I did my little hospital tour, I saw those straps and I was like instant, like fear. And I said, I can't do that. You can't do that. And I had a wonderful OB physician that allowed me, he listened to me. He was like a midwife, I guess I want to say. He listened to me and he said, don't strap her down. And I remember getting slapped. My hands were slapped because I touched my legs. And oh. you mentioned the Lamaze classes, you know how they said, try to sit up, grab your legs to push, things like that.
Right. Right.
And that's all I was trying to do, but I got slapped.
Because it was sterile.
Because I was messing with the sterile field. And I remember saying, my legs aren't sterile. Yeah, but right. you know how we used to do all the draping and stuff like that.
It draped. It was amazing.
Yes. Yes. So if we fast forward up, one of the things I think that's really cool is in 2020, we had a pandemic. I'm like, people went, what are you doing? You're telling me I can't have my, I love the handcuff vision. I can't have my birth partner, whoever that is, or my mom or doula or whoever they've chosen to be at their side to help them give birth. I can't have them. The pandemic made people go, I want to be in charge of my birth. I want to have people with me. The idea of birthing alone caused so much fear and anxiety for women and families, and men stood up and said, I have a right to be there, even to the point where they're infecting their wives and baby with COVID because they're testing positive, or they actually actively have the disease. People were fighting. They stood up and fought. And so the hospitals were caught in this pandemic public health safety initiative. How do we do this with a birthing woman? And who gets to come in? And here in Kansas City, I love this. They started calling us and they're like, how do we do this? Help us with your policies. How do you discharge somebody quickly? What do you think we should do? Should we allow the doula? And I'm like, of course you should allow the doula. You know, of course you should allow the birth partner.
And allow breastfeeding. And I know that I was giving my students the informed consent forms and informed refusal forms that evidence-based birth put out, because, you know, I do not consent to you separating me from my baby when there isn't evidence saying that that's best policy. So when we go back to that, I think, have we changed? What has changed for the better, be it shaves or be it LDR rooms? But have we really changed the underlying? I think of it as we have better wallpaper in some ways, but we haven't changed the underlying philosophy when you talk about birth as risk versus, and the medical model view of birth versus this being, what is the midwifery model? How do we inculcate the midwifery model into birth in a bigger way?
There, another change that did happen from 1980 to 20, or in the process, I think this is a continuum, is breastfeeding.
Yes.
In the 50s, moms were going to work and they needed another way to feed the baby. The breast pumping world wasn't really there.
Wasn't there.
It was manual expression, which doesn't work. And for moms that go to work, or that turn into single moms, and you know, it became problematic. So formula grew, and then it became formula was the primary way to feed your baby. So even in 1980, rooming in was unheard of, as well as breastfeeding. So we have, again, it took the American Academy of Pediatrics to be the voice on getting breastfeeding into our systems, our house systems, and make that change. On the out-of-hospital world, it's normal. I mean, we actually are, you know, we have two birth centers in the Kansas City area. They kicked us out of the breastfeeding databases because we skew the data because everybody breastfeeds. And when we have a mom that doesn't breastfeed, it's so foreign to our team. I have to keep reminding them, if there's a reason they don't want to do it, leave them alone, because it's foreign to us. Mm-hmm. But the out of the hospital world is so much different than the in hospital world. I mean, and so how do we bring that in? That's right. Why we have our midwives delivering our patients in the hospital. We are imparting. If we can deliver somebody at home or in our birth center, they can't have the same birth in the hospital. If they want to squat on the floor, right. I'm going to squat on the floor with them. If the hospital doesn't like it, I'll do my best to help clean up the mess. That's what I just say. You know what I mean? We're going to work with it. And we have worked with that. And we are making changes, but it takes that constant drive for us to do that. We have to constantly be in the, I don't want to say in the face of people, but Hillary, you said it, educating our families to say, this is what I want. Can you please help me understand what you're saying to me? Give me informed consent for why I need to have my food removed. You see what I'm saying? Give me the reason, right. You know, because if our families can be their voice, that I believe is what makes a change. And one of the things we tell them, we have in big letters, you are normal until proven abnormal. Get this idea of risk in your head out. You are not risky. This is a normal, your body was made to have babies.
Well, and how do we impart that to clients as well? And has there been a change in the people who are having babies? So I was just talking with a friend of mine who's also been a midwife for over 40 years, and that's about how long I've known her. And she is collecting data in the Mennonite community and finding that the cesarean rate is under 5%. Mm-hmm. And what do I go back to within that community is the understanding that we are mammals who are meant to give birth, the knowledge that my sisters and my mother and my grandmother and all of my cousins have done this over and over. And it's not an anti-medical use of medical model when it's needed, but there's a belief in the fact that the birth process works. And so how do we bring that back in as well?
Right.
So one of the, now I just lost it. There was another big change that's happened. I'm interested in the data for 2020 and even as we move into 2021 to see with the surgence of people leaving the hospital because of COVID, because they can't have the people, visitors or whatever, the support people, the fear, and then also the fear of they're going to take my baby if I do test positive for COVID. It's been a big stretch. I know that a constant drive makes change. It happens through the consumer. It happens with reimbursement rates. It happens with contracts, you know, Blue Cross Blue Shield, things like that. And it happens with changing birth. And as long as we continue, I'm a firm believer in the education of the client. I'm a firm believer because they're your voice. And we have been told in Kansas City that because of house, we are willing to stand up and take the hits and in a professional manner, explain why we do what we do, right? And be received that we are changing the birth community. For example, doing something inappropriate outside of the hospital and then transferring in doesn't happen anymore. You know, what I'm getting at is transfers are appropriate. They're not coming in with a half-born breech baby anymore.
Right.
Because the birth community has become safer. The birth community has become more patient-driven, client-driven, family-driven. All of those people are the same. And they are asking to be left alone, to have less intervention. And the hospital, that we, the people that we work with, actually respond. We are, for example, I'm going to do a big stretch, a lotus birth. You know, we have a large a population in our area that it believes in the spirituality of lotus birth. And they, I'll tell you what, I know your baby's sick and it's going to end up in the NICU, but the NICU is willing to keep the placenta and cord attached until it naturally drops off. That is a huge stretch. And I'm so proud of our NICUs for doing that, because I know they hate it. And I know there's a big concern about infection and bloodborne pathogen crossing over and all that. But that's how we stretch. And I am so thrilled, because it just takes that constant push of people like us to say, hey, how can we actually meet what the patient wants? And the C-section rate is one of those incredible things. It took women dying because of C-section related, surgical related deaths, that the movement, again, this started in the 80s, the movement, the deadly delivery movement, that was 2010, put out by Amnesty International. That kind of movement has made the march of dimes, where we need these quality organizations to step up and say, it's got to stop.
And that was Amnesty International as well. I was involved in 1982, 1983. I lived in Syracuse, New York. And that was when it was actually called CPM, what is now ICANN, which was, yeah, it was a cesarean prevention movement at the time. And it started in Esther Zorn's basement.
Awesome.
And I remember her.
Right. And on an Epson. We didn't have computers then. It was an Epson word writer. I put in the first mailing list for the sending out the Caesarean Chronicle. And we had people coming to, I was in a home birth practice in Syracuse at the time, and was actually at one of Esther's children's births, but we had people coming to us because they didn't offer VBAC in the hospital, and they wanted to know if they could have home VBACs. And I think it was that kind of push that led to VBACs in the hospital. But of course, we saw VBACs increase, and then ACOG comes out with, oh, you need all these things in the hospital, and we see the VBAC number plummet. And so how do we also look at what are the different forces that have happened, because it's certainly not a straight line.
Yes, you know, there's definitely not.
So there's the where have we been, and there's also the where do we want to go. You know, I think that some of the things that this pandemic has brought up, back to the closing of all these small community hospitals, the I think of it as industrialization, but corporatization of healthcare. There are so many things that have been exposed by the pandemic. And my hope is that we can say, okay, maybe all those rural hospitals aren't coming back, but can we look at having rural birth centers, having outlying birth centers? Can we look at the utilization of telemedicine? And there's been an explosion in the use of televisits. What are the things that we can take from this to say, how do we build better? Oh gosh, we've got an inauguration. Isn't it Build Back Better? How do we build this back better for maternal health care?
Right.
Kathy, I'm going to add a quick thing to it. All I kept thinking about with all the closings of the hotels is like, Kathy needs her birth center franchise to go to the next level. These are some great birth center facilities all over the country. That's all I kept thinking about.
Absolutely. We do. We need more options for families. And for some people, they don't want to deliver at home, because the birth center and the home are really the same. The big difference is everything's in one place at the birth center, and right, you don't have to put it in your car, and you always have staff, and it's centralized. But we need more birth centers, and part of those changes are happening, but with regulatory process and laws and statutes and stuff, it'll all change. But you know, one of the things we didn't mention, that from 1980 to 2020, right in the middle, you guys know what happened. electronic records, 2000. That's when it started coming out. Yeah. Or that's when it became meaningful use kicked in.
I was just going to say meaningful use. Like I can't know, you know, I need someone's BMI on paper to know if we need to address it rather than looking at the person walking through the door.
Right.
Those electronic records changed the entire practice, didn't it?
Oh, without question. Without question. One of the things you said earlier, Kathy, that I think is important is that our students come to midwifery programs afraid of birth.
Yeah.
And when I taught at Georgetown, I abolished the requirement of having had to be a labor and delivery nurse first.
Yay!
I hate that because I had to break them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they'd come in really proud. I've done 10 years of labor and delivery, and I'd be, oh, no.
Yeah.
Because we had to break them of having people on the monitor all the time, being afraid of what was going to happen. Yeah. And I used to always, you know, but something can happen. I'm like, what is something?
Yeah.
Tell me something. And, it was really hard. And I was able in those days to make sure that everybody got out of hospital birth experience.
Great.
And especially the ones who were most afraid of it.
That's awesome. That's what we need. That's what we need. They need to see that birth is normal and not medicalized.
And so I think a growing number of our students are coming to midwifery. They're coming as nurses, but they have not necessarily had years of experience in labor and delivery. They're coming in younger and younger, so with midwifery as their primary goal. So many of us came to midwifery after we had been in hospitals in labor and delivery. And I remember saying, I can do this better. I know I can.
I was going to say, in 1980, Carolyn Flint, who's from England, wrote a short piece that I have always kept called Should Midwives Train as Florists? And it was when direct entry midwifery was disappearing from England, which it really got down to just two schools that were teaching direct entry midwifery in Britain at the time. And then there was a resurgence of it. And she said, well, you don't have to train to be a policeman to be what they call a solicitor and we call a lawyer.
Yes.
You don't have to go to medical school to be a dentist. And in the same way, midwifery is its own discipline and all of the healthcare knowledge should be learned within the context of midwifery,
not
nursing. And so my little hill I'm going to die on is that midwifery is midwifery is midwifery and it's not nursing. And that why do we do this? Why do we pull from nursing to make midwives? That we need to start looking at other countries and around the world, and that midwifery is its own discipline. And I really believe in direct entry midwifery. And that's not to exclude nurses, but it's to say that nursing is not the foundation of midwifery and it's not the only way to learn it. And so I really am a fan of direct entry education.
Right.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say globally, I've had the opportunity to I've delivered babies in 12 countries, work in 40 some countries. And they're all, most of them are underdeveloped. So my eyes, I work with these direct entry midwives, and those that actually have a certificate of midwifery, they do get general nursing, but they all become, but then they go directly into midwifery. So they have this solid education, oftentimes without textbooks. It's the same model. And they're incredible. They're masters. They taught me so much about these are my real eyes. These hands here, how to use your hands to determine everything and to do better assessment, to be a better, stronger midwife when I'm out in the middle of somewhere that there is no hospital, there is no physician to help me. And so I'm 100% agreeing with you. And I stand with the World Health Organization on the goal that every woman deserves a trained birth attendant.
Right.
In birth. And it's just because not all births are perfect. And you just need somebody to help with their eyes, the ears, and these right here, these hands to determine and to watch for and safeguard you. Otherwise, it's like birth is normal.
Right.
So what we have here is
physicians don't learn that.
No.
They really don't.
And it's interesting, before we started and we were talking about ultrasound, and ultrasound can be wonderful and revealing of anomalies, and it can be reassuring of health, but it also causes people to lose those hand skills. And so it's the knowledge, in the same way as it's the knowledge of, yes, fetal monitoring was developed for use in high-risk situations, it was shown to be advantageous, but in all those studies is not advantageous in normal birth. And in the same way, as I'm thinking about, many years ago, I had a client of mine who was seeing a perinatologist. She did have preeclampsia, and her baby was breech. And she went to this doc, and she said, oh gosh, my baby's still breech. And he said, how do you know without ultrasound? And she said, because I'm getting kicked in the bladder. You know, that
moms know.
Well, and I still have my students learn how to use a fetoscope. You know,
oh, yes.
I think confirms the fetal position. Oh. Don't just depend on the Doppler. You know.
Right.
Really learn your Leopold's. No, use your hands. Yeah. It's also, and I keep bringing in things that I've read, but there was an article in Midwifery Today many moons ago, by someone who had been a labor and delivery nurse, and then she went to nurse midwifery school in Minnesota, and the first thing that she was told is, I want you to just sit with laboring women.
Right.
And she thought, oh, I'm being demoted. But she learned, all she had to do was sit and labor sit with woman after woman in labor. And some of them she didn't even have a common language with. And that's the piece. We don't, you know, we talk about how many catches do you have as a student. That's not where you learn birth. You learn birth sitting with women in labor and watching the progress of it over and over. And you get to know, in the same way as after you've heard 40 babies' heartbeats on a newborn exam and you hear the one that has the click in it, you know it's not right because you've heard all the normal. In the same way, when you've watched labor after labor, you get that feeling in the pit of your stomach when something's not right. But it's because you've sat with laboring women. And I think we don't do that enough.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the reasons I think doctors do not understand normal, is that few, if any, of them have ever sat through a whole labor. Right.
I agree. Well said.
They really don't do that. And it's no wonder they love epidurals, because they walk in, the patient's miserable, they give her an epidural. The next time they come back, she's happy and says, thank you. Well, why wouldn't you do that? Unless you really understood normal and how it interferes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And unless you really watch the joy on someone's face after they've given birth without any medication. And yes, they yelled plenty in the beginning, you know, during pushing and such, but the joy is priceless.
Yeah.
Well, I think it comes back to that fear when you guys were talking about the evolution of all this knowledge we have at our fingertips, and the clients, the patients having fear, the not seeing natural. So the midwives, the anyone trying to be on the labor and delivery unit on staff or supporting women, they have a fear of normal themselves. They're uncomfortable hearing. I mean, I remember being labor and delivery, and the lady down the hallway that's screaming and hooting and holler, it makes everybody uncomfortable on the unit. Right. And so it is. It's a big cultural shift, and how do we go back to the other direction?
I remember having an anesthesiologist who was mortified when women were naked. It just drove him absolutely crazy.
Sometimes it's also, you know, when I hear about Catherine. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
When I hear about Kathy and the positive changes she's making in the hospital, and I think about transporting somebody who was being transported at 7 centimeters and, you know, for whatever was going on, and I was in the elevator with her. She was going, and I just kept going, "You sound great. Yes. Let it all out." And as you know, we got in the room and I just kept doing it so that nobody was going to make her be quiet. I just kept affirming how wonderful that was. And by the time she got checked, she was complete.
I was just going to say, it sounds like she was moving.
She was. So,
you know, my reaction to that, when I've had patients like that, is every transfer is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And so that you bridge that gap with the hospital, every transfer is appropriate. I don't care what's going on. Even if they deliver when they arrive, it's still appropriate. If the mom needed help and that made her feel like she's getting help, it's an appropriate transfer. So thanks to the hospitals. We're glad when we need them. Let's get our
I look back right on. I look back on early days of keeping moms in bed for their whole labor and such. And then they weren't delivering. So we would take them down to radiology for a pelvimetry.
Oh my gosh.
Those were the days.
X-rays.
And the effect of moving them to the radiology table and the positions they had to get in and putting them back in bed. We always took birth kits with us because we delivered them in the elevators coming back up again because they moved.
I love it. That's another change from what was happening in 1980 to now what's going on in 2020, because they quit doing pelvimetry somewhere in the 80s.
Thank goodness. Yeah.
Yes, thank goodness. It is funny, those x-rays. I took one in. My sister had She had a pelvimetry, and they gave, she was a veterinarian, so of course she wanted her films. And I took them in. I was working in the ER, and I took them in. I go, "Hey guys, come and look at this film. Tell me what you think." And I put it up, and they're all like, "Oh, it's a headless baby," right? Because the baby was so low in her pelvis, but it didn't show that. It was great. Anyway, x-rays were funny. I'll just say that. Pelvimetry x-rays never gave you the right picture. And they did them because they wanted to see if the baby would fit through the pelvis.
Right. That's exactly right.
Don't need that intervention. Babies are made to fit through those pelvises.
And the baby's head is the best pelvimeter there is.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yes.
Well, I think that, Leslie, I will encourage you on this. I think there's some more topics coming out of this.
I'm taking lots of notes, Kathy.
Especially as we move into things. I have two books. Like, I'm sure, Carolyn, I'm sure you know about this one, but Helen Barney's book on the history of midwifery is a really good read if you like history. And then this one is a little scratchy, but it's coming. It's called Medical Bondage, and it's about the gender, race issues. It's a hard read, but we talk about the history of midwifery and the rise of gynecology and how our practice was wiped out in the name of medical science, and how a lot of it was practiced on our Black women who were slaves. And so,
right.
It's a scary read, but it's a good read. And when you understand the father of gynecology and how he practiced without informed consent on women.
They took his statue down in Central Park. While you're doing histories, I wrote this book, which is called Circle of Midwives, for MANA for their 10th anniversary, and they reissued it for their 30th. And it's interwoven conversations with 25 midwives who started MANA. So
interesting.
The other branch of U.S. midwifery.
Thank you for sharing that. Sometime I'll share you with Leslie my book sometimes, but it's
I was just thinking I need to add to the website a resource list. You guys send me all your wonderful recommendations and I'll put on my page all the books that are out there.
Looking at how many are on the shelf, right?
Yeah.
Well, I'm enjoying this immensely. I mean, you can see from my face the knowledge you guys have, and I think we need more stories like this. We need more of the world. We have this internet. We have this technology. These voices need to be heard to the masses of how things have changed, the better, the worse, and like you said, the pendulum swinging, and how can we keep this momentum going?
Yeah.
Well, and how do we not lose the knowledge of elder midwives? And that when I talked about my friend in upstate New York, she's also in the between 65 and 70 range, and she's also worked in different places around the world, and the knowledge that we've gained and that we have to pass on, and it's not just in programs. I think I'd like to brainstorm on having elder midwife circles, and how do we not just one-on-one, but are there other ways that we pass that on? So just some ideas for the future.
That's a great idea. Yeah.
I would love to go back to the direction. I know we had joked about it, but we were talking the technology piece. We've talked about the interventions during the birth itself, but let's talk about the technology of all this knowledge that everybody has access to, not just the evidence-based side for the clinicians, but also for families, like how that dynamic has shifted for the internet and the knowledge at your fingertips. Or if a provider is given a recommendation, your client, patient could be looking up on the phone. So I'd love everybody's perspective of that evolution.
Are you talking about Dr. Google?
Yep, Dr. Google.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one thing we didn't talk about that since 1980, is when the World Wide Web got developed and it became the resource center. You know, one of the things that is unique to, and it's happening today, is how words are getting new definitions. And we have now different kind of dictionaries, the Urban Dictionary versus the Webster Dictionary. And one of the things I've experienced, and I know these ladies have too, a lot of people will research, they claim research, they'll get information from bloggers and or tweeters on certain things that they think is good for them, but they don't understand what they're saying. One of them is, you know, Hillary, you talked about teaching midwives how to use a fetoscope. That's a gift, because fetoscopes mm-hmm. are not used. And people worry about the use of a Doppler and radiation, I'll say it that way, or, you know, the microwaves. They don't think about this cell phone sending off that same kind of energy either. They don't think about that. They don't think about the Wi-Fi in our world and how that's changed. And this is a whole topic on epigenetics, Leslie, and how we're changing our bodies. But the World Wide Web has challenged us to maybe stay one step ahead of what they're looking at. And I've always told our patients when they come in with something that I've never heard of, can you share that with me? Here's my phone number. Send me the link, because I need to be educated so that I can give you the best response. And for example, Lotus Birth, I did a huge symposium, brought in all the hierarchies. We talked about it, brought in a ton of our moms, and they shared with why it was important to them. We tried to get a really good understanding of why is Lotus Birth so important to you and why should we do it, and came up with a great policy on it. I'll say it that way, where, like I shared, the hospitals are open to it, but the World Wide Web doesn't give Lotus Birth the right information, and it gives a lot of false information. And my example on that is it's a lot of work, and they don't understand, the mom, that how do you put a baby to the breast and manage this placenta that's decaying? They don't understand that they have to do something every 2 hours. they're exhausted. Not only did they just give birth, but now they have a baby that demands of their time every couple hours. So my point is being is that's part of what we're seeing with social media and the World Wide Web is half information. It's not the big picture. And so for us, we're challenged to give the big picture and to stay on top of things and give basically what I call, again, informed consent. I think Hillary brought it up already on really what is the idea of what you're about to do in the big picture, like the cell phone and all these microwaves that could happen from a Doppler or an ultrasound. You know, Carolyn, what you're doing is bad because it's causing birth defects, right? And you're like, wait, right. Let me put that out. Let me put that fire out. And saying yeah. That cell phone in your back pocket is worse because it's about the megahertz. I mean, I did the homework on that one. So
I like to make people aware of if they're going to use Google, that instead they should use scholar.google.com and not use any of the .coms, but what they're looking for is scholarly information, but also to make that available to people, whether it's just the abstract or the summary. And so I tell people that I'm both an educator for and a facilitator of informed decision making. And so it hasn't been so much on lotus birth, but things like vitamin K or circumcision or water birth, or GBS, GBS treatment or whatever, that let's look at what does the research say, let's put it into word terms of what we can have an intelligent discussion about it. I want you to be an information consumer, but an information consumer of good evidence-based information. And I know that I mentioned it way back when we were talking about COVID, but I'm thrilled about sites like Evidence-Based Birth. So I don't know if you guys are familiar with it.
Yeah. But
I think that having those summaries of the, saying to people, no, I don't really want to go look at your .com, but let's look at what the evidence has to say, and then let's have a discussion and let me facilitate your decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. We refer a lot of people to Evidence-Based Birth. There's a lot of good sites. Even we refer them to UpToDate because UpToDate exactly. actually gives the incredible data.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I always found people to be receptive when you wanted to sit down and talk with them about the real facts and reasoning behind things and that kind of thing. Not to say that what they know is not right, but let's look at the facts and where they come from and why this is what we do and what we recommend.
So another direction that we haven't talked about, but I think is very apropos of the day, is how do we expand the pool of who becomes a midwife? And when I talk, and I'm going to go back to my little, I said the hill I'm going to die on, which is midwifery education and expanding what we see as midwifery education, is how do we make midwifery education more accessible and more affordable. And okay, I'm going to tell you that I have, that I take issue with the more and more degrees. And I don't think you need to have a doctorate to be a midwife. I think we need to be expanding the clinical part of education, and that I think that graduate degrees, advanced degrees are great for people who are going to do research and who are going to go on and teach. But I think we need to be innovative in expanding midwifery education, because then when we do that, we have more people serving their own communities. And so here in New Mexico, it's the people who are starting the Navajo birth centers. Mm-hmm. It's going to be different in every community, but I think that we've created too many barriers to education. It's really sad to see when a student graduates with $150,000 in debt. And that's not an exaggeration.
It's not an exaggeration. It was one of the things that I hated the most teaching in a school like Georgetown, where it was so heinously expensive that, and I hated sending students out knowing that they weren't going to be making salaries that would pay back that debt in a reasonable period of time. It's just out of proportion.
Yeah, and I do think it's something that we as a midwifery community need to come together on, because as we keep hearing, and it is true that we need to diversify the midwifery workforce, we need to think about innovative ways to make it more accessible to more people who want to become midwives.
Right. Well, we need more and more and more midwives. There's no question.
Yeah. And I don't know what it looks like at the hospital that you transfer to, Kathy, but I know at our local hospital that has more midwives than OBs, and where anybody who comes in who's at least 35 weeks gets a midwife, they have a 13% cesarean rate. You know, and it's not the 5% of 1969, but it's also not the 30% right. of the U.S.
Right.
And there are three hospitals in town, and that's the one who utilizes midwives to the highest extent, and they have the lowest cesarean rate and good birth outcomes. And so how do we get that at all facilities around the country? How do we keep promoting that midwifery model? If you come in and you're in labor, and even if we need to have an OB involved because of some other issue that's going on, that you have a midwife at your side when you give birth.
Right.
So,
absolutely.
So how do we promote that?
Well, we used New Mexico as our example here in Kansas, because 65% of your babies are born with the hands of midwifery, and
it's not quite so high, but it's
way behind. But we're using it, and so I think we just have to keep doing things like what Leslie's doing, is promoting midwifery and getting the word out. And we have decided in our community, we decided this about 5 years ago, we have a billboard that we own at a major intersection of highways in our city. I-70, you know, that's the one that was built from Washington, yeah. D.C. area all the way to L.A. I-70 and one of our other highways that goes north-south instead of east-west. We have a billboard that says, every woman deserves an incredible birthday. See a midwife. And it doesn't say, see a nurse midwife. It says, see a midwife.
A midwife, right.
And so we're just going to, no matter what, it's worth spending the money to promote midwifery. And that's where we have to be, because that's what makes the change.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you all have people that say after their birth, I want to be a midwife like you, right? Yes. That's how we make more midwives.
So I have, my license plate is midwife. And here in New Mexico, and just to talk about how different it is in New Mexico than other places, gosh, when I was in upstate New York, somebody asked me if I was if midwife, what's that? Is that a surrogate mother? But here in New Mexico, I had taken a flight somewhere, and I was in the shuttle bus, and I pointed out, you know, how the shuttle bus takes you back to your car and the parking lot, and I pointed out, and the guy looks, and you're a midwife, and I get to hear his birth stories for his kids, you know, because in New Mexico, we do have so many midwives.
Yes.
And it's not, it is birth center and it's home birth, but it is a lot hospital birth, and there are midwives in every hospital in New Mexico. So yes, it changes the culture, but we also, it's unique in that midwifery was never wiped out in New Mexico the way that it was in other states.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So some of it is that there were parteras and we had licensed midwives. I went to the funeral of one of the licensed midwives who was licensed here originally in the 1940s and practiced through the 70s. We never lost licensed midwifery.
Wow.
So the ACNM, we also had ACNM who came out of the public health nursing in New Mexico when it was first incorporated in New Mexico. MANA was first incorporated in New Mexico. There was midwifery training of CNMs in Santa Fe. So we've never lost it here. And I have been at births where every generation has birthed with midwives. Isn't and I've been at births where every generation has birthed at home. So, mm-hmm. you know, I do know we're unique and I'm privileged to be able to be part of that tradition.
I would love to hear your guys' perspective being the young, innocent one on the group call. But the midwifery expectation of the profession, I think, has evolved drastically as far as, okay, I'm going to be on call. I'm small and private and personalized. And the next generation, I don't know if it's because our life's gotten so crazy and both family members are working. Many of the midwifery new graduates are morphing towards larger practices, call coverage. I would love to hear your guys' perspective on the expectation of the midwifery side and how that's evolved.
There's a different work ethic in 2020 than there was in 1980.
Amen. There's just no...
That's a different topic.
Okay, I will add a big, we'll do a teaser to that one. But yeah, I just wanted to hear if you guys thought it was work ethics or if, I mean, the healthcare demands, the burnout's more. And I was curious if you guys thought it was more of the mental expectation of work and what it looks like, or if there's other things at play that we could do something about. Because there is getting, I think there's just so much burnout, but I don't know if that was always there and it just wasn't as much talked about.
There's a cultural change in the United States, and it's called We Deserve a Break Today. It's in our media, it's our fast food mentality. We want everything quick and fast, and being up all night is not the norm. People are struggling, and it is hard to dedicate your life. Again, we have signage in our hallway, one of our hallways, and we put the families, pictures of our families, our staff, and their family, and it says our family is giving to your family. And what that means is we're promoting the fact that it takes an entire family to support a midwife in what she does. Because you could be saying, yeah, we're all gonna go to church and then go get some pizza, and oh, your call phone just went off. And you gotta have another car or something. Or you leave them stranded. You know, you have to always have a backup plan, and people, the respect of that is not there, and people just kind of want to do the doctor thing and run in when the baby's crowning and catch the baby. That's not midwifery. So again, that's a cultural shift. It's a whole other hour.
Culture shift. There's no question.
So I just assumed that it came with midwifery, was being on call. And I assumed that if I made a commitment that I was going to follow through with it, and did it through having my kids and raising them and them going off. And I wonder do you guys think that the cultural shift, I mean, I feel like midwife is as much a part of the definition of who I am as anything else. I have been a midwife my entire adult life, and it's in me, and I think of it that way. I wonder if it's that idea of a profession versus a calling. So
that's good. That's a great, Leslie, that's a great title.
I do. Yeah. I was thinking, yeah, profession versus calling. Yeah, because I think it is. It's to be honest and transparent, because I think a lot of midwives go in with it in school and training. Even the fallout rate, and Hillary can account to this, of CPM starting an apprenticeship and not going through the process because I would love to have ways for us to make a better realistic expectation of what midwifery, and is it a profession? Is it a calling to you and your identity? And maybe it'll help you. Because I just, yeah, that's what breaks my heart, is just seeing how much of, so many people have the heart for it, but then there's things they just don't realize, or maybe there's things in our system we could change to make it a little easier. So that's why I was just curious.
Well, it's hard on families. There's no question about it. I've had the blessing of having tremendous support from my family. But they also know I'm a midwife. That's who I am. That's just who I am.
My daughter, who went to college to study anything but healthcare, after right. You know, she came to her first birth when she was 2 weeks old. I just put her in the bassinet. Yeah. You know?
Right, right.
She now works for Google and has regular hours. So.
And probably makes more money.
Oh, twice as much.
Absolutely. And we wouldn't trade it.
No, so. I've loved the trek I've had in life. So, yeah. And I have a very supportive family. It takes that. Otherwise, it doesn't work. There is right. a calling.
On the other hand, I do wonder, and I know you were going to say something. I keep talking over people.
No, you're fine. I was just saying it's been an hour. I just think you guys, I want to make sure you're good with the time. So. Yeah. Okay.
I do think, though, that there was a sacrifice that my family made and my kids. Mm-hmm. And I don't know in the looking back 30 years, was it good or bad? I think they saw what it was to have a dedication to what you're doing, to really follow through on your beliefs. But I do know that it was hard. And so I, in the same way as I would like to envision midwifery and education and access, I also think that we can envision practice models where we have small groups. And I know I talked about midwifery in England in the 1980s, and they started what they called was the domino, and it was domicile something. I don't even remember what the acronym was about, but it was a small group of midwives, and you as a client or patient knew you would get one of those three or four midwives, but it right. wasn't that same model of you knew you would get that one. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, by saying, okay, we are a group of three and we are going to have off time, because that's how we regenerate and have and bring it back. And that we do have to look at the models that work within small practices.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. That's the
it
model.
Requires you to trust your midwifery colleagues and yeah. Have a lot of confidence in them as well.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
I think Kathy's model is definitely the hallmark of what we'd want to strive to as far as a balance. I mean, I think you guys have all hit the nail on the head. Like, we want to be moms. We want to be midwives. We want, being on call 24/7. And like, it still blows my mind. A lot of midwives will be solo private and they won't ask for backup call. They'll take a whole month off, a 5-week window, just so they can get a vacation. And that's the extent. Right. So yeah, Hillary's one of those ladies.
and their moms don't deliver without them.
Yeah.
They wait. I learned early on that they wait. And I remember once I told somebody that my plane was going to be arriving about 5 o'clock. Uh-huh. And I was still on the plane when she called and said her water had just broken. And yeah. I was on call.
That's happened to me too.
When my daughter was in high school, I took her to Europe for a month, and I took a month off so I could take her. And I walked in the door and there was somebody who her water had broken, and I had no idea what time zone I was in, but yes, it happens a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think
it's
that's
been
just
really delightful getting to know you guys.
You as well.
I was going to ask all of you, because I think I would be honored to have this as a quarterly tradition, and I'll send an email of brainstorming topics, because you guys are such a wealth of knowledge, and I knew your personalities would nicely complement each other. And I know a lot of the followers and the people listening will just, I know it'll be very exciting for them to hear. So thank you all for your time today. If you want to give a little summary, any little 2 cents advice to the midwives listening or aspiring midwives, your wisdom advice in 2 minutes. Hey, Kathy, you could start.
I'll just tell you my advice, my the words I've always used are all babies are born and they're normal and they're healthy. And just to keep that, you're normal until proven abnormal. Keep that in your head forever and ever as a midwife.
Love it. Carolyn, if you want to go next.
Well, I was just going to say birth is normal, and we need to preserve, even when someone is very high risk and there are all kinds of problems, the actual process of her labor and birth are likely to be normal, and we need to preserve whatever normality there is for her. And that's our mission.
And I want to talk to those who desire to be midwives, that if it's your calling, follow it, that it's a gift.
And it keeps coming back and to get you. So you might as well just go after it.
Exactly.
Oh, well, thank you so much, ladies. I truly enjoyed it. And I will send you guys a group email to see if we can, everybody's busy schedule and being semi-retired and lots of grandbabies and vacations hopefully coming up once the lockdowns go away. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Leslie, for having us.
Thank you.